of Liberty.
Welcome, one and all, to I Remember When, Times Gone But Not Forgotten, a series of radio programs on the history of Philadelphia through the memories of those who have lived, loved, and labored in this, the fairest city in the land. Return with us now to the days when Doe was politician and the Republicans controlled the city from the roots of its hair to the soles of its feet, as we take you back to flesh times for the GOP for part two of Gang Rule in the City, or the most perfect party organization in the world.
You may remember that in our last program, we heard of the many means by which boss Bill Vere and the Republican organization ran Philadelphia during the 1920s. We heard about personal service, the credo upon which his political base in the immigrant wards of South Philadelphia was built, about the by then highly refined political science of making votes, the role of the magistrates, some of the coercive aspects of the Republican control, and more. Well, today we're going to continue our exploration of politics in the world's greatest workshop, turning first to the structure of the organization itself. Now, the tendency is to imagine the old city bosses as running their urban kingdoms with an iron fist. And though Vere, at the height of his power, would enter his candidate for ward committee with the remark, "Here is your ward leader, elect him," in truth, his kingdom was more a confederacy of strong chieftains than a dictatorship, as Joe remembers.
Now, the Vares were not the only ones who were. They were in control of South Philadelphia. Then they had the Trainer brothers, who were also very active. And they were in, after Prohibition, I think they owned some distilleries and whatnot. They had a powerful say. And then out in West Philadelphia, you had a man who was the Republican ward leader in the 24th ward, him by the name of Blake McCone, who was then the clerk of the Quarter Sessions Court. Now, he had a lot of patronage to give out. In fact, he was my opposition during the time he became active out there, and we had a lot of trouble about jobs and various other situations that occurred. So that these were leaders in their own individual vicinity.
Right.
There wasn't any civil service involved as it is now. There was a civil service, that's true.
But
it wasn't functioning
control.
Because it was the kind of a civil service that if you got on a list and they wanted to put somebody on out of that list, they found some way of doing it, whereas now, of course, you have the first three or whatever.
Right.
And even today, it probably some maneuvering being done. But in those days, it was done pretty openly. And, of course, the police were under the control of the political forces.
So patronage, I think I just read that in 1926 there were about 20,000 city jobs. And I guess that with that many jobs to dispense, really could give you a lot of
the job
control.
The job was the controlling factor. If the somebody in the family, whether it was a son or daughter or husband or wife, was able to get a job, they in turn, of course, on election day, did their part for the Republican Party.
Jobs then, along with personal service, formed the twin pillars of political control, with money being the cement that held it all together. Now, in 1925, there were some 20,000 city jobs, and many more in county, state, and federal jurisdictions, most of them doled out by the Republican leaders and filled by those in service of the organization. Let me give you some examples. In 1931, 1,828 of 3,132 precinct committeemen were on city and county payrolls. In the Bureau of Weights and Measures, 98 of 1,198 inspectors were committeemen, while 23 of 32 mercantile appraisers and 19 of 28 magistrates were members of ward committees. 14 of 31 clerks were members of ward executive committees, and it goes on and on. Once on the city payroll, these committeemen's job was still to work in the division, and many of them did nothing else. So the organization could mobilize a literal army of faithful workers, all owing their livelihood to the party, whose primary responsibility was to ensure its continued success. Now, as long as there's been patronage, there's also been political assessments, the kicking back of a prescribed portions of one's paycheck into the party treasury by government employees. And Philadelphia, again, was no exception to the rule. Where these employees were paid, however, is illustrative of how far the organization and city government had merged into each other, as Saul, then a reporter with the Inquirer, relates.
As a matter of fact, they set up their office and the building and the old bank building across the street from City Hall toward the east, the building on that corner. And the Republican City Committee headquarters is what it was. They later moved to 15th and Market. And every payday, all the employees came to the Republican headquarters to get their paychecks and to make their contribution to the Republican Party.
This is into the 40s? 30s, 40s? When?
This is at least well into the 30s, because Clark was elected, I think it wasn't around 1941.
Clark's elected in 52. In
52?
Yeah.
He took office in 52 and was elected in 51. Yeah, okay, yeah. So it was into the 40s. And because you couldn't get a job unless you were going to ready to give a piece of it to the Republican City Committee. And the guy who ran that, I don't remember his name, he's a little tough egg, and he could get anybody, put anybody on the starvation list simply by telling him, well, you're done, don't bother coming back next week.
No.
But that's where they got their pay, not from any city. There was no city treasurer's office.
They were paid right at the Republican committee office.
Yeah, now somebody in the city hall made out
the check.
The amounts and everything, yeah.
But taking the deductions.
Right? Yeah, but they had to go up to city committee to get it. Now, that is really hardline politics.
The party was the government, plain and simple. And political control extended throughout the municipal departments, where its iniquities periodically burst into the public view in a series of scandals and investigations. Now, the police usually took the brunt of these attacks, diverting attention from the true sources of the sickness. And though by the end of Smedley Butler's tenure as Director of Public Safety in 1925, the police dependence upon political favor had become somewhat more covert than in the good old days. By the late 1920s, during the last fat days of Prohibition, they were again running the protection rackets for prostitution, gambling, and bootlegging, activities not just regulated, but often run by the police brass and local politicians.
They had almost a laundry list of prices. The captain's man, the captain's bag man, would go out in the district and see whoever it is that's supposed to pay. It wasn't only the whorehouses, it was any kind of business. They had a protection menu for businesses.
Huh.
And the man would go out and he'd bring it back to his captain. The captain would decide who got how much. And usually there was a definite amount, so much a month for a captain, so much a month for a lieutenant, so much a month for a patrolman on the beat. And this was widely known. And that we have had very fine cops who are in important positions in the police department who could play it either way. If they had a mayor who would tolerate it, they would steal along with everybody else because they didn't want to waste that money that was available. But if the mayor wanted to run straight, they would run it straight.
Hmm.
And they weren't the worst cops for having that attitude. The cop is a very...
That was the nature of life?
Yeah. Yeah.
How long did this continue, do you think? This run through the 30s?
Protection was all part of business as usual in the Quaker City, but occasionally it did run into some snags. There were two major investigations of the police in the 1920s, and another a decade later in 1938. In fact, it was a police investigation in the late 40s that helped finally lead to the fall of the Republican machine in the mayoral election of 1951. A grand jury went after the magistrates in 1935, and another one after voting fraud in 1940. Now today I want to look at only one of these scandals, the grand jury hearings of 1928, for they provide a sterling example of how things were done during the heyday of fair control. It had been over 2 years since Marine General Smedley Butler had been driven from office, his efforts to enforce prohibition and clean up the police department thoroughly thwarted by the organization. By early 1928, things were again getting out of hand. The city governments had problems with a series of overexpenditures on the Delaware River Bridge, on the New Art Museum, and from fat contracts with the construction companies of Vere and his cronies that were all coming to a fiscal head. Then, too, bootlegging and gangland murders were getting way out of hand as Philadelphia's notoriety began to approach that of Chicago. Mayor Harry Mackey was even promising a new crackdown on crime. And then Huey McClune got blown away in a gangland slaying at 10th and Cuthbert. Now, McClune was a popular fellow, clerk for colorful magistrate Artie Carney, an ex-mascot of the Phillies. He had a lot of friends. And it just so happened that at the beginning of August, not long after Huey was settling his final accounts, Bill Vere suffered a stroke, temporarily putting him out of circulation. 2 weeks later, Judge Lewis issued his charge to the grand jury, and the war was on. Before the dust settled in December, some 89 members of the police force were suspended, 18 dismissed, and 63 arrested. They even went after some of the politicians, like Matt Patterson, leader of the 19th Ward and member of the state legislature, who, found guilty of bribery and extortion, was fined and jailed. The best part of the hearings, though, had to be the stories of how policemen, making $1,500, $2,000 a year, were able to accumulate savings sometimes amounting to tens of thousands of dollars. Never expecting to be caught, they did not come very well prepared. John, then police reporter with the Inquirer, got the scoop on the McClune murder and later covered the grand jury hearings.
There had been an abortive one earlier, but this was a big one. And they found that police captains had all sorts of money. And one of the police captains, under investigation, they raided his house and they found $27,000 in cash under the rugs in his house. He couldn't put it in the bank, he couldn't spend it, and he had it under the rugs. And another one, when they subpoenaed his bank account, he said that he had made all this money, and it was up in the thousands, raising canaries in his attic. This is true. This is actual testimony. And they found all sorts of things. And I remember one sergeant told me that he went to make a pickup for his captain, and he took $1,000 off the payoff and took the hubcap off his car, and he put the $1,000 in the hubcap. But searched his car, they never thought of looking in the hubcap. The money was in the hubcap all the time. They never did find out what Charlie did with his money.
The following March, a second grand jury led to the dismissal of another 85 officers. It really took quite a while before Vere was finally able to bring things back to normal. Then again, as another example of how entrenched the organization was, when a police captain, discharged for his inability to explain a fat bank account, was brought before the grand jury, he was already re-employed as a payroll clerk in the city treasurer's office. The party took care of its own, let there be no doubts about it. So what impact, then, did the grand jury investigations of 1928 and 29 actually have on the police department? Sam covered the police beat for the Philadelphia Record in the 1930s.
If you weren't in with the Republican Party, you just didn't open anything or do anything. And they controlled the police force from the top to the bottom. Even after the grand jury, there was so much corruption still in existence that they used to have regular demotions, regular explosions, shifts. What's the word I'm after? I am getting old. They would just go through that police department and shake it up from top to bottom. They would transfer 5 or 6 inspectors. That was the top rank in those days. 5 or 6 inspectors and maybe 8 or 10 captains and a whole mess of sergeants. And usually, the sergeants who were hit most were the street sergeants because they were out where the action was. And they'd bounce those guys around. If a guy was out politically or if somebody wasn't working right in his district and, you know, working with the politicians, he might find himself on the opposite side of the city the next morning. Or he might live down in Eastwick and be sent out to Mayfair, be assigned out to Mayfair. Or if he had a job that a lot of police were after, bing, they broke him back to a beat patrolman and gave him, you know, some outlying district where there was no action, a residential district like somewhere out in Chestnut Hill or West Philadelphia or down in South Philadelphia where a lot of politicians lived and a lot of money people lived in the old Girard Estate.
Yeah. So it was in the interest then of the policemen to make sure that they gave proper attention to the political leaders, or their jobs and incomes would be in jeopardy.
Oh, certainly. As a matter of fact, many of them owed their jobs to politicians. They bought them. Now, it was never proved, but a fellow reporter on the record had known about it, as most police reporters did. The standing price was $300 for an appointment to the police department. And, you know, civil service was a joke. And he had lined it up through some friends, and he was going to be introduced to a politician, and he wasn't that well known yet. This is how early it was in our careers. It was, I guess, around 30 or 31. But he had it lined up, and he went to the city editor. He was going to get an appointment to the police department and a payment of $300. And the city editor thought it over for about a week, and then he decided not to do it. Now, I don't know. I think the entrapment laws have always been on the books. But I think that the record just didn't want to get tangled up in an expensive lawsuit in case they did put the money out. And also, $300 then was a good slice out of the city editor's budget.
So what, one might ask, were the newspapers doing to expose the graft and corruption so endemic in the city?
I'm surprised that with the corruption, I mean, the upfront corruption in the Republican organization all through early 20th century, that there weren't more big investigative undercover stories breaking it wide open. You'd think that a newspaper or a journalist could make his or their fortune on
I think some of the
those sorts of exposures.
Corrupt and content, not corrupt, but as contented as the Philadelphia population. I guess they were... I don't know who the hell owned all the papers then, but I can't remember the huge exposés, big expose type thing, like we did later and the other papers did on politics in those days, except for the graph on a grand jury book.
But even the Record, being the Democratic paper in the city, wouldn't want to keep pounding?
It wasn't then, because Stern didn't buy the Record until 1928.
Okay, well, early 30s then. When you
They did plenty of it. Yeah, but they were just getting started.
They did a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah, quite a bit of it.
During the 1930s, the Philadelphia Public Record was the city's Democratic newspaper. And though it ran investigative stories and exposés on the organization, well, who was going to listen? Over and over again, I've heard the same story. People just accepted the organization's style of government as a fact of life. But what then were the Democrats doing? Surely the opposition party, ever ready to exploit any weakness, any sign of scandal, shady associations, or potentially conflicting interests, surely the Democrats could make great political hay out of the blatant and complacent Republican corruption, right? Wrong.
Now, see, in the 1919 charter, and it was retained, it was in the city commission, that have to be one of the minority party. So what the Republicans would do, they'd pick their two, then they'd go get some Democrat, buy him off, and he was their stooge in there. He was nominally a Democrat, but he was in control. He was controlled by the majority Republicans, and they would get. They always took some weakling to be their Democratic stooge. It's as simple as that. Yeah.
Hail, hail, we're full of cheer.
That was the old O'Donnell machine, sure.
Okay, who's O'Donnell? It was
John O'Donnell was the so-called Democratic leader in the city of Philadelphia. Well, actually, he was a Republican plant. He and his party, they had so many Democrats, so many Republicans registered Democrat. That would assure them of getting any minority position that, by appointment that had to go to the minority party, the Democrats.
South Philadelphian John O'Donnell happened to be a friend of Bill Vere's. Both he and the Democratic Party in the city received their patronage from the Republican organization, and apparently were quite happy to take whatever handouts the GOP was willing to offer them. Even O'Donnell's office was paid for by the organization. In exchange, they filled some of the minority positions, ran candidates, and in general carried out the pretense that a two-party system did indeed function in the city of Philadelphia. Most people knew what was going on, and it all ran quite smoothly. Gee, things were really just swell. So what happened then to bring the whole structure tumbling down? Well, let's go back to 1926, the year that Vere, at the height of his powers, realized the dream of a lifetime. For it was in that year that little Billy Vere, the youngest son of a South Philadelphia truck farmer, was elected to the Senate of the United States of America, the most prestigious men's club in the Western Hemisphere. Unfortunately for Billy, he would never occupy that seat, for he had failed to pay proper respect to Pennsylvania Governor Pinchot, who, in a fit of pique at his own defeat in that contest, attached the now famous Certificate of Doubt, calling into question the election returns. Now, in truth, the Senate election of 1926 was no more tainted than any other state contest at the time. But the Philadelphia upstart was getting too powerful. The investigation unleashed by the certificate would drag on for the next 3 years, sapping Vere's health and his political strength. His seat was finally refused because of excessive spending to win the nomination, even though he had been outspent by his primary opponent. According to his biographer, John Salter, Bill Vere's real crime was that he was a ward politician without social background. He just didn't have the breeding to be United States Senator. In 1928, Vere suffered his stroke, and Judge Lewis opened his attack with the grand jury investigations. Then in the November presidential elections, the stalwart Republican wards of South Philadelphia defected to Democrat Al Smith, even though a Republican division leader played Democratic ward boss for the occasion. The greatest party organization in the world was under attack, and then the Depression struck. Voters by the thousands, disillusioned by the failure of Hoover's promises, dropped from Republican Party ranks, and like Hal and Sam, turned to Roosevelt.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth...
You voted for Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
First time you could vote in presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, I think along with the entire country, I just figured that Hoover put us in the Depression in 1932. He was in 4 years. He promised a chicken in every pot and two cars in every garage. And by 1932, people not only didn't have the chicken in the pot, they didn't even have the pot.
Mm-hmm.
Or the garage, or their homes, all they had was bread lines. By 32, it was chaos. It was horrible, really horrible.
Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Everybody was promising pie in the sky, but it seemed like Roosevelt was able to get across to the people better than Hoover did at the time. And unfortunately for Hoover, he was promising things that people just didn't feel confident insofar as his being able to produce. Franklin D. Roosevelt became like the knight in shining armor. He was the guy on the white horse. He was the guy who was going to turn everything around.
And I was the kid with a drum. Say, don't.
The Depression hit Philadelphia hard, forcing thousands of people out of work and cutting back the hours and pay of others. 1933 was the worst year, and the unemployment figures are really quite interesting in how they compare to our current ones. At the bottom of 1933, 11.5% of the city's native white population was out of work, 16.2% of its blacks, and 19.1% of the foreign-born. Under such conditions, the Republican Party was bound to suffer. Vair and ill health saw his control slipping, and Mayor Hampi Moore didn't help matters any by denying the plight of those in need and refusing to consider any governmental programs for relief. Remember, by the 1920s, Philadelphia was the last major city in the nation in which all public relief was still in private hands. Patronage, too, broke down as Moore laid off 3,500 city workers, cut the salaries of others, and the ward healers' promises of jobs and aid went unfulfilled. Then, too, the crisis brought on by the Depression provided incentive for local chieftains and young upstarts in the immigrant wards to lead their districts to the Democrats. Though long the chief recipients of personal service and aid, the new immigrants had by and large been excluded from political preferment, the better jobs going to men with English and Irish surnames. And now many hope to take those positions by riding the National Democratic wave to victory and ousting their erstwhile Republican benefactors. In 1933, the O'Donnell machine declared political independence, and later that year, a rejuvenated Democratic Party under the leadership of two Irish contractors, John B. Kelly and Joseph McCloskey, won the municipal elections by 84,000 votes. The strains of the Depression also made merchants and businessmen less tolerant of the graft and protection rackets, tapping their small and diminishing funds. You may remember from the end of last program Joe's description of how his father, a butcher in West Philadelphia, along with other merchants on his block, were being shaken down by inspectors from Weights and Measures. Now, in good times, this was all part of life as usual, but not now. For once the Depression had demonstrated it meant to stay around a while, folks began to take on the organization. Here Joe, motivated by his anger at the pressure put on local merchants, recounts how he helped get the Democratic Party started in his division of West Philadelphia.
Well, I, as a young fella, couldn't see that. So I got really mad, and I said, well, it looks like we have to do something about changing the situation. So in those days, there was registration. You had a poll tax, a registration where you paid, I think, 25-cent poll tax. I don't know whether you ever came across that or not, but that's...
I heard one woman mention a poll tax and was unclear whether...
Those people who did not own any property had to pay a poll tax to register. Those who owned property were exempt from the poll tax, was a quarter. So I made up my mind that we ought to increase the registration. In our division, I think we had 8 registered Democrats. And most of them
out of
were...
How many
Well, there were 400 or 500 votes.
Yeah.
Out of those 8, 2 or 3 of them were... were registered by the Republicans. They're actually Republicans. As a result, they would control the election machinery in that division. For instance, you'd have to have a minority and majority represent judge of election. You also had assessors in those days who were appointed by the Republican, but they had to have a minority representation so that they had these pseudo-Democrats, formerly Republicans. Anyway, out of the 8, there may have only been 2 or 3 who were honest-to-goodness Democrats. Yeah. Well, I, as a youngster at the time, just starting out, felt that ought to be changed. So we got together, 2 or 3 of us, and stood around at the time the registration came along at the polling places. And we got 100 quarters together, and as people came in, we said, here, you don't have a quarter, you get the quarter. We registered 100 Democrats. So our division was one of the few who really had a lot of Democrats, more so than the rest of them. As a result, the next time we were able to elect, let's say, a judge of election or whatever. That's how the thing started in our division. After a while, the others start taking root too.
Joe was elected to the state legislature as a Democrat in 1935, and though Philadelphians throughout the decade would vote Democratic in presidential and many state elections, the Republicans won the city back that same year. They would retain control for another 18 years until Joe Clark was inaugurated as mayor in 1952, finally ending the 84-year reign of the Republican machine. The Clark and Dilworth administrations marked the beginning of a whole new era in the city's political history, but that all takes place after the period covered in this series has ended. So what then finally happened to Bill Vair? Well, in 1929, the Senate finally refused him his seat in a vote of 58-22. Though in declining health and plagued by defectors and pretenders to his throne, Vair ruled on from his home on the Jersey Shore until his death in 1934. Upon his demise, the papers joyously proclaimed the passing of the last of America's old-style political bosses. Little did they know. So how then should we sum up our tour of politics in the Quaker City between the two world wars? Now, the great temptation is always to want to make some sort of judgment on the goodness or badness of boss rule in America's cities, and in particular on the reign of William Vair in Philadelphia. On the plus side, the Republican machine did cater to the needs of and give political voice to the thousands of new immigrants residing in the city in the early years of the century. Vair himself supported workmen's compensation and child labor laws, women's suffrage, local improvements, and opposed the bane of all newcomers, prohibition. On the minus side was the endless corruption and graft, the inefficiency and waste, favoritism, and the tolerance of, when not actual participation in, criminal activities. Just some of the things you've heard about in the past two programs. But what strikes me as being more important than weighing off the good against the bad and coming up with some final call is the notion that the Vair organization and the infamous Philadelphia political style would never have existed had they not been a manifestation of the times and appropriate to them. The idea that keeps coming back to mind is that of personal service reciprocated by a personal vote. It was a world of face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball politics, one based on a personal bond between the politician and his constituents, a paternal relationship of service reciprocated by trust. The same personal and paternalistic model that was supposed to guide the relations between an employer and his laborers in the city's workshops, and also between parents and children in its homes. It was all of the same ideological cloth, rooted in the economy, the peoples, and the material conditions of the times. Over and over again while interviewing, we were told that what held us together was poverty. In a world in which the only safety nets were provided by friends and family, in which education and travel were limited, and in which one's life revolved around local, first-hand experiences, a world of comparative isolation from types and volumes of social information that we all take for granted today, this personal form of paternalism was the model of how things were supposed to work. And then came the Second World War, which again, in interview after interview, marked symbolically the end of an era and the death knell for a whole way of life. In the succeeding decades, America underwent profound changes across the board in its economy, its transportation, communications, and domestic technologies, its standards of education, changes in the very structures of everyday life. And so, gradually in some parts of the city, more rapidly in others, the old personal and paternalistic style of social relations and of politics had to change. Now, personally, I have no desire to go back to the days of boss rule and machine politics. At the same time, wouldn't it be nice to return to an era when you had someone to turn to about taxes, services, legal or money problems, and you could place your trust in a benevolent leader who'd help you out and look after your needs? Now, in exchange for those services, you permitted him to rip off as much as he could, for as long as he could, as long as things didn't get too out of line. That was his right. And it also provided another model of the American dream, of how a man could better his condition and make it to the top, in a world in many ways rougher and yet kinder than our own, in Philadelphia, the world's greatest workshop, city of homes and brotherly love, graveyard of organized labor, corrupt and contented.
Philadelphia, my hometown, cradle of liberty, where each heart beats true and they welcome you. Thanks for her loyalty. Let's sing a praise through all our days. A
while happy people lead in every line. When your jingles of tapes of county and guard right here, Philadelphia all the time.
Contributors to today's program include Joseph O'Minsky, John Calpin, Sam Barry, Sol Schrega, and Hal Lassie. Your engineers have been Ron Carson and Jay Goldman. Your host, Charles Hardy.
Philadelphia, my hometown, cradle of liberty, where each heart beats through and they welcome you, aim for a loyalty. Let's sing a praise through all our days, how happy people lead in every line. Right here, jingles of tapes of county and guard right here, Philadelphia all the time.